The composer of the music is in the unique position to know not just the notes that are to be played, but how they are to be played. That certainly ruins the element of surprise for the composer, but it doesn't ruin the joy of hearing the piece played, and it definitely doesn't ruin the joy of hearing the piece played well. The whole point of a painting is to hang it up and observe it, to spend time looking at it. But to take a Bach concerto and hang up the paper on which it's been printed and just stare at it, that's criminal. It's meant to be played. It's meant to be enjoyed by hearing it and by playing it. The whole point, at least for the composer, is to hear what was once only in his or her head played back to him or played back to her, played back by a musician or played back by a whole group of musicians. And in that, even the composer can be moved. Or maybe it's better to say that that's precisely the point. That's what the composer really wants, is to be moved by a musician that truly knows, that truly loves, and truly can play that composition. But, and I know that just because an analogy can be utterly exhausted doesn't mean that it should be. But if you'll humor me, just a statement or two more on this. It's also true that while a musician can only play, I think it's always true that a musician can only play one note at a time. It's probably better that they only play one note at a time. But while the musician can only play one note at a time and is always confined to that measure in which they're currently playing, the composer is everywhere. The composer is in every note. The composer is in every measure that has been written. Simultaneously, the composer knows the beginning and the ending and everywhere in between. There's nowhere that the composer does not live. The composer knows what was supposed to have happened, what did happen, and what is yet to happen. So when our God, when our Father makes a promise to us, He already knows. In fact, He's already there. The passage that was read for us a moment ago from Deuteronomy 31, the words of the inspired prophet and lawgiver Moses to Israel. The words of God, the promise of God to Israel was, I will go ahead of you. I'll go before you. That's a promise that God has always made to His people. The promise He made there in Deuteronomy 31 is the same promise He continues to repeat. It's the promise that He repeated as they left Egypt. I'm the Lord who brought you out and who will bring you into the land that I promised you. God wasn't just there in Egypt and there in the wilderness, and I didn't tell Danny to do that. What a great tie-in to the lesson, though. But God was already there in Canaan. The disappointment of the spies coming back, the 10 of the 12 spies coming back with the bad report. What did they see when they looked into the land? They said, well, we see all of the produce. We see it's as beautiful and it's as plenteous as God said that it was. But we also saw the people over there. And we were like ants in their sight. Do you know what Joshua and Caleb saw? They saw God. God was already there. Did they not see the same fruit as the other spies? Did they not see the land that was open before them? God was already there. And Joshua and Caleb saw it. The others saw men, and they were fearful. God was just waiting. The disappointment of the 40 years of wandering is that they missed out on 40 years with God, who was waiting for them. This is the language of the composer who has put all of the notes on the page. Now, I know, and I know that you know, that all analogies ultimately fail or break down at some point. They can't be pressed into forever. That's the nature of an analogy or a parable. If you grant every detail the same amount of value, you break it. But this analogy, at the very least, of God as a great composer who takes what is in his mind and writes it, creates it, so that someone who is willing might pick it up, might pick up their instrument and give it everything they've got, to the absolute bliss not only of the composer, but also to the musician himself or herself, or anybody else who happens to be in the vicinity of that musician. That analogy may offer us more clarity on the tremendously difficult theology, because theology isn't meant to be understood absolutely. It's limited by definition. Knowing God just means knowing what little bit of God we can hang on to. The actual theology of God, the actual study of God, is so deep, and so great that it would make Noah's flood, the flood of Noah's day, look like an overflowing thimble. The theology is so massive, we can't wrap our arms entirely around it. It's God by definition. It's beyond that which is human. That doesn't mean we can't know anything. Of course we can. We can know some things. We don't know everything. We don't know nothing. But we can know some things. That's why analogies matter. That's why parables matter. They're not meant to give us all the theology. Although I would suggest that within them is all the theology. We just don't know how to get it all out of there. One study of one parable We can't exhaust it. You haven't exhausted it. I can't exhaust it. Collectively, for 2,000 years, we haven't exhausted it. It's in there. We'll never get it all out. But the analogy works. The parable works. If we'll listen. And that analogy of God as the composer may give us more clarity on the difficult theology of God's foreknowledge of what we will choose in conjunction with our freedom to choose than anything else. You can't keep pressing it. You'll just press into things you don't nor can understand. But you can understand what was just said, can you not? You can understand what a composer does and how he or she does it, how they are everywhere in the composition simultaneously, and how there is a musician who can pick up that composition and only be in an isolated location of that composition, yet the composition having already been written, choose to play what has been written. Press it further and fall off a cliff. But accept it for the truth that it is, which is that the player, the musician, can trust the composer. The composer knows where this is going, even if the musician does not. We often speak in terms, and the Bible often speaks in terms, of God commanding us to obey. Well, my goodness, if our society couldn't be helped by anything, it might be with just a little bit more sternness sometimes with saying there are some things that you're going to have to obey. And to obey means you don't get to toy with it. You have to just obey it. You have to go with it. And there's nothing wrong with that. We need that. But I do want to suggest to you that it's only a fraction of what God imagined and how to convey to us the beauty that's in it. With equal force and with an entirely different sort of beauty, we can say that God invites us. He calls to us to come, to take his music in hand, to pick up the bow, to place it on the string. And we always find that no matter wherever or whatever we've been called upon to play, He's there. He was already there. He went before us, prepared us, and he's waiting for us in the next measure. The writer of Hebrews said of our father Abraham that by faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed, by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. The writer goes on to say, that was Hebrews 11:8. The writer goes on to say in verse 10 that he was looking for a city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Abraham didn't know when he left his home of Ur of the Chaldees, how it would end when he started. He didn't know what the last note was going to be, when or where, what key. He trusted the architect of the city. He trusted the composer of the concerto. What was Abraham doing on Mount Moriah in Genesis 22 along with his son Isaac, if not picking up the bow and placing it on the string, playing God's song. God, our Father, must have been moved to tears when Abraham struck those notes. So when Jesus arrives in the world, Jesus' ministry could be summed up in a lot of different ways, but maybe the shortest way to do it would be with the two simple words that he used, which were, "Follow me. Follow me." Those are the words not just of the great composer, but of the great composer playing his own concerto, picking up his own bow and putting it to the strings. And Jesus, the man who God was, Jesus invites us not only to listen to him play, but through his playing, inspires us to take up our instrument and play. The beauty of Jesus is that we get more than just words on a page, words to be hung up on the wall and stared at. Jesus said to his disciples in John 14, "I am the way." Not, "I know the path." Not, "I can see the path from here." "I am the path. I am the way." We don't have time. We don't have all the time that we might like this morning to talk about Jesus telling his disciples in Mark 14, 28, just before he dies, "After I have been raised, I will go before you into Galilee. I'll be waiting for you." Sounds like something God would have said. Showing them and showing us that wherever it is, to where he is taking us, he's already there. He's waiting for us. "Go. Go play my song. Everywhere that you go in your life, I have sent you. I'm already there. Go play my song." What is the gospel? What is this evangelism thing that we talk about? Go play my song to your husband, to your wife, to your children, to your neighbor, to your coworker, to your enemy. Play. Pick up the bow. Come. Take up the music. Play. Play my song. Play my song so that I can hear. I love that song. Play that song. I love the way you play it. Just play my song. And God has always wanted us to go. This really isn't new. In Genesis 1, before anything happened, before anything negative happened, God told our parents, "Go! Go! Fill the earth! Subdue it!" And what do we do? We don't want to go. We want to stay. We want to clump together in Babel. We want comfort. We want more predictability. I'm not excused here. We want our favorite, don't say it, pew. We We want to circle the wagons and protect the ghost of what used to be. We want endless coda and return. We want to keep going back and playing the same measures over and over. We build our towers upward. And God says, no, outward. Don't make me come down there and ruin your tower. And what do we suppose God does when we start erecting them? As we wrap this up, what does it sound like to you when you hear the masters of their craft play? If you've ever heard, as Sam and I had the pleasure of doing, the San Francisco Symphony or the Cleveland Orchestra play Bach or Stravinsky, doesn't it move you? Isn't that what Bach wanted? Isn't that why he wrote? Imagine what Jesus must have sounded like to our Father. But you've also been to those recitals too, haven't you? At the grade school and the middle school. It gets a little better in high school. You've heard your children and your grandchildren play Edelweiss or any of those standards, and let's be honest, not all that well. But you knew you weren't going to hear the London Philharmonic either, didn't you? But at least they weren't just sitting there staring at the paper. Or worse yet, trying to convince us that they were actually musicians when in reality they just liked the way the notes looked. At least they had the courage to put the reed, to put the mouthpiece to their lips, and take a breath. At least they had the courage to pick up the bow and strike the string. They have the will to try. They have the desire to do what some only ever talk about doing. At least they have the courage to go. And so when the concert is finished, you may have heard the screechiest thing you ever heard in your life and sat through that for an hour and could have sworn that it was 11 hours. But when the concert is finished, what do you do? Do you stand up and give two thumbs down and boo? Shame on you if you ever did. My goodness, they're children. No. You rise to your feet. You shout. You whistle. You clap. You praise. You thank God in your heart for these children who had the courage, who had the audacity to get on that stage and to be brave and to try. And what do you think your Father does when you have the courage to go and try? How do you think your Father feels when you pick up your bow and taking up his composition, you strike the first note and you keep playing? And where do you think he is whenever you get to wherever he's calling you to go? As always, We give everyone opportunity to consider the condition of their soul this morning. Will you play? Will you play for the great composer? He made you to play this song. He invites you to come and then to go. Confessing your faith in Jesus, repenting of sin, putting him on in baptism, you can go on your way rejoicing and playing his song. And if you're a child of God who hasn't been very brave, we hope that you'll change your mind. He doesn't expect you to be the London Philharmonic. There's only one of those. But he does expect you to try. Will you pick up your bow? We can help or encourage you. Would you let us know while we stand?